Welcome aboard to the Badass Outdoors podcast, the first podcast, actually. So the person that you're listening to, my name is Ashley, and I am the Ash of Badass Outdoors. I'm a former salmon and steelhead guide out of the Pacific Northwest, the great PNW. Salmon and steelhead, that experience taking folks out fishing really has enriched my life so much. You know, the whole outdoors lifestyle has enriched my life so much. It's given me, you know, stories to tell around the campfire, memories that I'll never forget, the opportunity to meet some amazing people, and nothing makes me happier than to share my stories, experiences, and learnings from other people who love the outdoors as much as I do. So for this podcast, think of it as a chance to talk about all of the things that happen on the way to a fishing trip and back, on the way to the river and back, or out hunting or whatever. Because really, the camaraderie and the shenanigans that come from these moments are sometimes some of my favorite memories of all. That's the kind of stuff that we're going to be talking about. Those shenanigans, tips, techniques, the things that are fun to do outside, cooking, fishing, hunting. If it can be done outside, we're probably going to cover it at one point or another. Please share this podcast, tag Badass Outdoors in a post, get the word out, ask a question while you're there, and I'll answer it on this podcast. That would be fun. So a few things that I'll do on this podcast, I'll have guests on from time to time, so you'll get to hear from other experts in the industry, whether that's fishing, hunting, etc. And if you have any other ideas of things that you would like to hear here, well, you know, let me know, because we can kind of do anything we want, which is the joy of having your own podcast. So I was Googling a restaurant in the Portland area, and what came up was the Columbia River. Like, not as a restaurant, just Columbia River, and it has reviews. So, to all of you fishermen and hunters, anyone that, you know, spends time in the outdoors, think about your favorite hunting area, location, fishing river, whatever. What would the reviews look like for that area? So I'll tell you what they look like for the Columbia River. Here are a couple of actual Google reviews on the Columbia River as a whole. Okay, first one. 1 star. I'm doing a homework assignment and trying not to be bored. So naturally, you go on to Google and rate the Columbia River. Anyways. Next review. Columbia River. 2 stars. It still smells. Anytime I've smelled it, like drove by a paper mill or something that's actually stinky, I have never thought, you know what? I'm going to review this because people need to know. People should know. Next one. Columbia River. 2 stars. Slow service with poor, uncooked food. 2 out of 5 stars. Bad seafood restaurant. Yeah, I would imagine that when you go to the river, the food, the seafood, the fish don't come cooked. why aren't these fish cooked already? I can't believe that people, that's really annoying that the fish out of the Columbia River aren't cooked. Okay, so I thought from there, okay, this is what the Columbia River gets reviewed as, you know, but what would the Pacific Ocean get? Would anyone go to Pacific Ocean on Google and review it? And the answer is, oh yeah, yeah. Actually, 18,192 people have reviewed the Pacific Ocean on Google. And guess what? The poor Pacific got a 3.5 star rating. So here's the first review. This is from a week ago. 1 star. For the Pacific Ocean. There's far too much water, and every time I visit, I get extremely wet. I would expect better from such a high-class institution with a reputation like it is known for. I would not recommend anyone to visit Pacific Ocean. Next star. This is a month ago. 1 star. Pretty Gucci has a lot of water. Chicken was fishy, the salmon cheesy. Some of the waiters are nice, but some try to ask me to go into the water, and I say I don't know how to swim. Pretty shellfish, to say the least. And I will also mention that this got 129 likes.
like, because you can go and like people's reviews. So 129 likes for the Gucci definition of the Pacific Ocean. The poor Pacific. All right, last one. A week ago, one star. This ocean is either neglected. Oh, it says it's either the neglected sibling of the Atlantic or the admired sibling of the Atlantic. I will have to say that the hurricane made the boat ride a lot less enjoyable, especially considering that the wind blew a flock of pelicans in my face. Well, I mean, the Pacific Ocean should be held accountable for such behavior. And the last time I got a flock of pelicans blown in my face, I immediately thought to review that on Google as well. Okay, one more, because the reviewer is called Flamp 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 Flamp. So take that for what it's worth. One star. Too much water. My wife and I visited this ocean last summer and found the sheer volume of water here was too much of an obstacle to render any activity enjoyable. I appreciate that when making an ocean, the inclusion of some water is necessary, but quantity such as this is wholly excessive and bordering on carelessness. Astonishingly sloppy from management, and while recent attempts to offset some of the water with floating plastic shows signs of promise. The reviewer feels it's simply too little, too late, extremely disappointing. The Pacific Ocean. 3.5 stars as an average. Wow. So naturally, once you think of, you know, what are people reviewing the Pacific Ocean? What kind of reviews do they give? I thought, let's take this to the next step. Because I don't think anyone in their right mind could possibly give the Grand Canyon less than 5 stars. It's the Grand Canyon. It's like one of the wonders of the world, isn't it? The Grand Canyon. So I had to check, and the reports are in. This is actually better. Overall, the Grand Canyon got a 4.8 star rating. 30,388 people reviewed the Grand Canyon. And as I look, you know, when you look at Google reviews, it gives you a breakdown. Like, most people gave it a 5. Some people gave it a 4. There's actually a handful of 3s and 1-star reviews for the poor Grand Canyon. And so what could these people possibly have to say about the Grand Canyon? Well, I will tell you right now. 1 week ago, 1 star. Too coarse and rough. I tried sleeping at the bottom. Never again. The next one, 1 star, more like the Grand Cameron. Just like my last boyfriend, I felt cheated from the second I decided to go through with this. Other things they have in common are that they're both super boring and are the driest, most shriveled up things I've ever seen in my life. The poor Grand Canyon getting compared to Cameron, the shriveled, dry ex-boyfriend. My goodness. And, well, okay, one more. Michael is the reviewer, and it's 1 star. It's just a big hole in the ground. It was far too big. I had to go around it for a very long time, downvoting until they built a bridge or something. How inconvenient this Grand Canyon has been for all of these people. Build a bridge over it. My goodness. So there you have it. I definitely encourage you, when you can, to go on Google and to look up your favorite places and see what kind of reviews these places get. You know, I mean, the glass really is half full to some and really is half empty to others, as we've seen from the folks who could muster up the creativity to give the Grand Canyon less than 5 stars, the Pacific Ocean, the poor Columbia. My goodness. There you have it. Google reviews. So next up, I do live events from my Facebook page. It's called Badass Outdoors. And generally, when I'm sharing something, I always throw out a question that says, hey, ask me a question. I'll answer it while I'm live. And so a lot of people send in questions. And here's some that I didn't get to answer that were very commonly asked during my live feeds. The first one, hey, Ash, what is your favorite bead color for steelhead fishing? So for those of you that don't know, bead fishing is a really popular technique in the Pacific Northwest to catch steelhead. So one of the things that we do, so here's the philosophy behind bead fishing. Salmon and steelhead, and we're talking about steelhead here. Hey, Ash, what is your favorite color of bead for steelhead fishing? This is a really great question. So right now in the Pacific Northwest, bead fishing is all of the rage. The last, I would say 10 years, bead fishing has been pretty popular. And just when I think there can't be any more information out there about bead fishing, you know, people still have a lot of questions about it. So that's awesome, for one. For two, the philosophy behind beads is that they look like salmon or steelhead roe, like a little egg. So as this little bead comes floating down the river, ideally into a steelhead's face, it's thinking, you know, I eat this. This is a very non-intrusive sort of thing. It's in my face. I think it's a really easy thing for them to just go and pick it up. It's non-intrusive. It's easy for them to eat. It's something that they already eat. And you can be really creative with these things too. They're fun to fish and fairly simple to fish too. So for my favorite color of bead, there are two trains of thought on this. One is the match the hatch kind of theory. So like I said, beads are meant to mimic an egg that may already be in the river that a steelhead would eat. So the match the hatch theory is that if you, for example, walk down to the river and let's say, you know, someone caught a fish there the day before, earlier that day or whatever, and there's eggs laying on the bank with some blood and guts, that if you were to look at some of those eggs in the water, you would see that they are starting to turn color, or whatever color they are, that would be a really good idea for you to use a bead that looks similar to that. So for example, if you see a milky orange kind of little egg in the water, you might pick a milky orange. Or if you see something that's more of a brightish pink, that you would pick something like that. So that's that train of thought. The other one, and kind of what I lean towards the most, I really like a candy pink bead because it works really well in most situations for me. It's generally one of the first things that I'll try. It's my go-to. If someone held like a gun to my head and say, Ashley, pick your one bead for the rest of your life right now. What do you pick? Gun to my head, I would say candy pink bead, 12 millimeter, and with a little bit of glitter on it. Kind of a pearlesque finish would be super cool. And so the way that I make that is I buy just a standard pink bead. I usually buy Brad's Killer Beads because they're really awesome base beads. And then I buy a little glittery, like pearlesque, transparent nail polish, and I paint it up with that. And my advice, if you're painting your own beads, always use a clear coat to finish them, like a plastic dip spray or some other sort of clear coat spray to spray them at the end so they don't chip. They maintain their integrity a little bit better and ensure that they dry all of the way before you go and fish those. Because here's a little tidbit of information. A fish can smell a single drop of liquid in like 150 or 250 gallons of water, some like large amount of water. Fish are extremely reactive to scent. They can smell very, very well. So the kind of acetone nail polish smell that you get from painting, make sure that that's all dried up before you go and run those beads. And there's even these little like chapsticks. Sometimes I put like, I use like a scented, like a krill scented chapstick or some sort of scent that I put on the bead before I run it through. Every now and then I do that, not all the time, but if I have it and I'll try it out, why not? So that's that. Candy pink, you know, probably 12 millimeter, a little bit of glitter, a little bit of pearl. It's deadly. I totally recommend that you try that out. And if you do, hey, if you try that, shoot me a message. Especially if you catch a fish, send me a photo. But shoot me a message. Tell me how it went. If you have any more questions on bead fishing, yeah, shoot me a message. I'd be happy to answer those for you guys. Cool. All right, next question. Have you pointed the rod butt to the fish when the steelhead or salmon runs to stop them? Oh, that's a really good question. So what we're talking about is when we're fighting a fish. So if you have a fish on and it takes off running, a prevailing bit of wisdom is that you point the rod butt to the fish when it's running in order to allow that rod to really load and bend and slow and stop that fish. So I kind of have some thoughts on this. So first of all, I don't generally do that every single time I have a fish on and it takes off running, because generally it really depends on the situation. So I usually use braided line, and I'm generally using kind of a heavier rod, and braided line means that there's not going to be there's not going to be any stretch in my line at all. So if a fish takes out running and I give a quick, like, if I like tug on my rod, if I like immediately just like point the butt right at the fish, that's going to be a pretty hard stop on the fish. And I definitely run the risk of something breaking, a hook popping, you know, pulling, just ripping the hook out of the fish's mouth in general. So I have to be really careful with that. I'm more inclined to let the fish run, trust the gear that I have, knowing that I'm going to be able to bring that fish up again. But I will let the fish run. And when it slows, or if I feel like it's slowed at least enough for me to start pulling its head around, that's when I'll start doing that and bringing it back to me. So yeah, as a general rule, if a fish is, you know, taking off, you do want to let your rod load up and help you fight that fish. But I wouldn't say just immediately shove the butt of the rod at the fish. You're definitely going to pull, you're going to pull some hooks doing that sort of thing. And again, all of this depends on, you know, the situation you're in, you know, how strong your rod is, how strong your line is. And so there's all of that to take into consideration. So good luck on that. If anyone else has some thoughts, again, shoot me a message. Okay, next question. We need some good recommendations for fishing bibs for women. I've looked all over for some that would fit my wife at local retailers, sportsman shows, and online, but I'm not having much luck. What do you use? Okay, so I get asked this question actually quite a lot, and the waders that I use are Sims waders. I use the women's G3 waders, but you have to kind of consider what the person's doing and the reason why you're getting them waders. So in my case, you know, the last couple of years, I've spent a lot of time out in the water. I fish on the Olympic Peninsula, you know, very upper left of the lower 48. I'm in the rainforest. It rains sometimes up to 130 inches of rain per year. You know, I'm climbing over trees and through forests and into boats and out of boats and crossing rivers. Sometimes when I'm done fishing, I'll go over to the coast because, you know, I'm not too far from the beach and go dig some clams. So I'm dealing with freshwater, brackish water, salt water, all sorts of conditions. And so it makes sense for me to spend the money, get the highest quality wader that I can that's going to keep up for what I'm doing. And I am not sorry about buying those Sims waders. They have really held up super well for me. And so that's what I will use. That's all I will use. That being said, there's two other things that I would share for picking up a new pair of waders. One is to consider how much these things are going to be used. If this is just, you know, a spare pair of waders, or, you know, if someone's going to go out once or twice or three times a year, I wouldn't recommend going out and spending hundreds and hundreds of dollars on a waders. You can buy a good pair of neoprene waders for a pretty decent price, and they'll keep you warm, they'll keep you dry, and that's the important thing. And so the other piece that I want to offer on this is that if you are trying to get your wife into fishing or hunting, or your girlfriend or sister or mom or whatever, keep in mind that if you're fishing or hunting, etc., in tough conditions, you don't want the cold and the wet to overshadow the experience. So you go out, you go fishing, you catch a couple fish, it's a great time, but the only thing that she remembers is how miserable cold she was. Like, that's not a good situation. So I would say to really prioritize something that fits. And if it fits, and, you know, maybe it's neoprene or something that's going to really trap some warmth in, that's going to be a really, really big deal. And if the lady's spending more time on the river, I would definitely go for the Sims female waders. And there's a handful of other quality waders out there, but above all else, go for something that's going to really fit. And it's not all about, you know, the, like, how you look in terms of fishing. Like, don't get me wrong, like, I like my waders to look nice. Like, I like to look good. Like, I want my waders to look good. There's nothing wrong with that. But even above and beyond that, when your waders fit, they can properly keep warmth in. That's why wearing men's waders for women sometimes, you know, if that's not your body type, like, whatever the men's waders are, that's going to be miserable because they're going to be baggy and loose, and it's not really good for keeping heat in. So bear that in mind. As far as some places to go, I usually go to Sportco for a lot of my stuff like that. And if you're not in the Pacific Northwest area, the company is available online, ships all over the place, sportco.com or Outdoor Emporium. Either of those things would be, yeah, they would be fantastic. Really good deals. I think one of the best prices that you can get on those things too. So good luck. And hey, if you have any more questions about waiters, women's waiters, again, shoot me a message, ladies. I want to know what works for you too, so that I can recommend that, because I'm sharing based off of my experience, but whatever yours is too, if you're in different areas, yeah, would love to know that. Okay, so next question. Your dog Ollie seems pretty well behaved. What are you doing, and what are some tips for other people to train their own dogs? Yeah, so I did. My fiance and I trained Ollie with the help of a trainer. So a lot of folks send their dogs to trainers, and that's totally cool. I know a lot of people that do that, but I really wanted to be personally involved in my dog's training. I wanted that to come from me because I wanted the experience of training a dog and understanding what I'm doing, and I wanted to have that relationship with my own dog because we basically worship our dog in this house. But anyways, so we had a trainer, awesome guy that works with us, and he trains us to train our dog. So some of the things that we've taken from that experience along the way, first and foremost, I would say that one of the philosophies that we always go by is to keep them honest. So anything that you ask your dog to do, ask them consistently and don't give like exceptions. So for example, if you're trying to keep your dog from like jumping on people when they come over to your house or something like that, don't let it be okay sometimes and then not okay other times. Like don't let them jump on you when they see you, but when your, you know, mother-in-law comes over and your dog goes to mow her down, like, and then to correct them in that situation is a little unfair. It's totally unfair, actually. So to keep them honest, keep yourself honest. Whatever you ask your dog to do, ask them consistently to do that and hold that expectation for yourself too. And along with that, a short story that taught me a lot about my dog is one day we were training Ollie. I think we were doing something with fetch. I don't quite remember. And he was really just dragging his butt. We would ask him to fetch and he would just kind of slowly drag his feet over, pick something up, slowly drag his feet back. He was just acting really, really bored. And I kind of got the feeling that he was just, you know, testing his limits as a young pup, that he just wanted to know kind of like, what can I get away with? You know, maybe I don't have to do this if I don't want to do it, that sort of thing. And so I stood up and we were kind of having that conversation of like, yeah, maybe we should just like cap it. You know, maybe he's just bored and, you know, tired. And then I said the T word. I said T-R-E-A-T. I said, treat, treat. And he jumped over, went and grabbed his bumper, dropped it at our feet, was so excited. And it's just because the motivation for him at that moment was different. And he was kind of testing to see what he could get away with, what he had to do, and what he didn't really have to do. So again, keeping him honest and knowing your dog, knowing things like that about your dog is good. It will help you keep them honest in training. Like, I know that my dog likes to avoid when he doesn't want to do something. He won't just flat out protest. He'll just kind of act like no one's there and turn his back and that sort of thing. So knowing your dog is really helpful. But remember that structure is something that they like, is another piece of training that's really stuck with me. That, you know, when you give them something to work at, something like a job, like waterfowl hunting, that sort of thing, to have like good expectations for how they behave around company, things like that, that structure is something that they like. So, I mean, remember that when you're correcting him, your dog, you know, to not jump on people or whatever, that setting expectations and creating an environment where they know what's expected of them is really a good thing and will help you in the long run. Something that I'm really glad that we did with Ollie is when he was a young pup, before we could start any sort of like waterfowl training, we would do a few minutes of behavioral training every single day. And we really didn't give ourselves the excuse of we don't have time, even though we were really, really busy during a lot of those times back then. We made it a priority, even if it was 3 or 4 minutes, we could all find 3 or 4 minutes to spend every single day with obedience training. And we did, even if it was just a couple sits and be done. That's something that we did, and it really paid off for us in the long run. And to set your expectations accordingly. Don't ask your dog to do something that he doesn't really know how to do. Don't expect him to do everything perfectly the first time. There's going to be a lot of trial and error on both sides, so be patient with that and set your expectations accordingly. So, again, I am certainly not an expert. If I didn't say it earlier, I am not an expert in dog training. I have only learned all of these things in the last year and a half when we got Oli. And so keep all of that in mind, that these are just the things that I've learned from my experience of trying to be the best dog owner that I can be while making mistakes along the way. So if you have any tips for dog training or any thoughts, yeah, shoot them my way, as always. All right, so I kind of want to wrap this up, and I like to wrap these things up on a high note, and so I want to talk about what I call the kinged salmon. So on this podcast, I'm going to call out somebody every week, and I will dub them the kinged salmon, the prized fish for this week, and that's going to go out this week to Grant Scheel. And Grant made a post on Facebook that challenged his fellow professionals to handle fish in a respectful way by keeping wild fish in the water, not letting them flop and bounce around on the bottom of a boat, and just, you know, respecting our wildlife. And I thought that was really awesome of Grant to do that and set that example, because a lot of folks look up to him. He's been in the game for a long time. I've fished with Grant and had a wonderful time. And we really need folks exactly like Grant to set the expectation for our anglers and for the new people that are joining, that we handle wildlife in a respectful way. Wild fish need to stay in the water. They don't need to be handled with abrasive nets. You don't need to use like wool gloves on them. Keep the gills in the water, not just their mouths in the water. And you know, if you're unsure of how to handle fish, spend some time, ask an experienced angler, look online. There's a lot of information out there, but Grant, you're the kinged salmon of the week for setting that example for everybody. Kudos, my friend. All right. If you want another bite of this information, please subscribe to this podcast. And while you're at it, throw a 5-star rating. Let me know what you think. I would love to know. And to keep swimming along with me here, join me on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube on Bad Ash Outdoors. YouTube is really going to be a fun one when you go and subscribe there, because I share my cooking, my fishing, my hunting, all sorts of shenanigans. If nothing else, you'll have a good laugh at the weird stuff that I do. So I'll see you there. Stay fishy, my friends, and until next time. Bye.